study. I have a set of books too large to fit on any of the shelves as they are currently set up. And so the place for those books is in a corner on the floor. Although the books are large, the print is especially small. In fact, with that particular set of books, there comes a special magnifying glass to enable you to read the very fine print. That set of books, some of you who may be oriented toward research may have already recognized as being the Oxford English Dictionary, which is a set of dictionaries that is particularly given for the study of the etymology or the background, the history of words in the English language. This past week, I picked up one of those volumes and looked up the word opportunity to find out from whence it came. I discovered, something I had not previously known, that the background of that word comes from the name of the Roman god Portunus, who was the god of ports, or the god of harbors, and that apparently as the word evolved through the years, it gave the notion that an opportunity was a harbor or a port into which one might pull in order to get respite from a particular storm or escape from a particular danger. It is a word that, of course, has come into our own English language with a port, even with an airport. Now, as believers in God, we, unlike those Romans who believed in Portunus, are convinced that the provision of the ports of safety amidst the difficulties of life come from God himself, that he is the one who provides for us the harbors that come in swollen seas or the airports from stormy skies. At least that's the way Nehemiah figured it. In Nehemiah chapter 2, he gives some interesting answers to the question of what to do when God gives opportunities. Actually, he provides three pieces of advice. The first piece of advice in verses 1 and 2 of Nehemiah chapter 2 is to understand that great opportunities often grow out of great dilemmas. In 1883, an insurance salesman wanted to sell a policy to a man who had a reputation of having resisted every other insurance salesman who had approached him. This particular insurance salesman was successful. I suppose he was particularly persuasive, articulate, perhaps creative in the writing of a $50,000 life insurance policy that over 100 years ago would rank among one of the larger policies that at that time was being written. It came to the close, and the contract was on the table. The salesman took out his pen, handed it to his client, who then went to sign at the bottom of the contract and thereby purchase the insurance policy. But the pen wouldn't write. So he tried again, and again, and again. And after repeated lack of success, he handed the pen back to the salesman and said, "I'd better think about this a little bit longer." The salesman lost the sale, and so he had a dilemma. A dilemma perhaps somewhat different from that retired postal worker who was sitting on the porch rocking in his rocking chair somewhere, I think, in Kentucky, as he watched the postal carrier bring the mail up the walk. It had his first retirement check. He opened it up, and he looked at the check, and he thought to himself, "Is this really all that my life has come to? Is this what life is all about? In retirement, do I just sit on a porch and wait for the retirement checks to come? There must be something more to life than that." And so he, too, had a dilemma, as did Nehemiah. Nehemiah recognized that the remnant of remaining Jews in and around Jerusalem were in bad shape, that economically, morally, politically, spiritually, they were just about destitute. And even though he was the cupbearer to King Artaxerxes of Persia, he really did not have the power or the means to do anything to resolve the dilemma of those persons for whom he was concerned. Jerusalem was a notorious city with a terrible reputation, both in the Babylonian Empire that had preceded and in the Persian Empire that was then in power. It was a city that had a reputation of being rebellious and continually fighting against the conquerors who had downtrodden them. In fact, the name of the city barely could be mentioned. And so Nehemiah knew not what to do except to pray. And he did pray. Prayed for 4 continuous months. Night and day he prayed. He fasted. He mourned. He wept. From the month of Shislev to the month of Nisan, he didn't tell anyone, the king or anyone else except God, that he had a dilemma. Nehemiah 2, verses 1 and 2 report his words, saying that in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now, I had not been sad in his presence, at least up until then. And the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, seeing you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart." Then I was very much afraid. Yes, Nehemiah had a dilemma. Not only a dilemma for those poor folk in Jerusalem, but a dilemma for himself as well. Understand that Artaxerxes was an absolute monarch. That really runs quite counter to our notion of individual freedom and democracy, but Artaxerxes had the right to order anyone executed, to take any wealth from any person, poor or rich, to redistribute the empire, to deploy armies, to do absolutely anything he chose, simply at his whim. And in those days, it was quite inappropriate for anyone to step into the presence of the monarch with anything but a good attitude and a happy face. And so when his countenance was noticed by Artaxerxes, and attention was drawn to it, it is no wonder that he said that he was afraid. For that which he had disguised, the deep hurt and the heaviness that was hidden within his heart on that day, had leaked out into the expression that was on his face. And so Nehemiah was scared for his life. Nehemiah had a dilemma. And maybe you have a dilemma. Something which you cannot seem to resolve. That which you have thought about late at night, lying in bed. That which has awakened you before the alarm has gone off in the morning. That which has taken all kinds of hours out of your day as you have made lists and you have reviewed all of the possibilities. And you've wondered and you've prayed and you've sought to resolve, but you absolutely cannot find the solution. It is a dilemma indeed. And while for a period of time you may have been able to contain the dilemma and the heaviness that goes with it into your heart, have you looked in the mirror lately to see that there are expressions in your face where the dilemma has leaked out, and those who are around you can see the quandary in which you have come? But remember here, we're working on Nehemiah's first piece of advice about opportunity. His advice is to understand that great opportunities often grow out of great dilemmas. Like that insurance man back in 1883, who went home distressed, deeply concerned, disappointed to be sure. He had told his friends that he had gotten the policy when no one else could, but he had lost the policy as well. He went back to his house and he sat down at a table in his chair. And he said to himself, actually out loud, "That will never happen again. I will invent a fountain pen that will always work." And so Lewis Waterman invented a new fountain pen and a company that produced it that dominated the American market in writing instruments for the next 50 years. His dilemma had been his greatest opportunity. Perhaps like that retired postal worker on the porch back there in Kentucky, who after the mail carrier had left, looked at his check and thought, "What am I to do with my life? What about me is different? What course could I take?" And so over an extended period of time, with paper and pencil in hand, he made a list of the things about himself which he considered to be unique, things which could not be said about anyone else, some of them silly things, unusual things, extraordinary things. Things like the fact that he was the only one who knew the recipe for fried chicken that his mother had left behind when she had died. It had 11 herbs and spices in it. And he went to a local restaurant and asked if it would be possible for him to fry up that chicken in that restaurant. And he did. In fact, it was put on the menu and it became the most popular item on that menu. So successful, in fact, that he opened his own restaurant, and from that initial restaurant, a whole string of restaurants until Harlan Sanders' Kentucky Fried Chicken became popular from coast to coast and around the world. He retired a second time, sort of retired. He sold the company and became an ambassador of goodwill for Kentucky Fried Chicken, sort of representing them roundabout, receiving a modest stipend of $250,000 a year until the day of his death. You see, he understood that great opportunities grow out of great dilemmas. Sort of like Nehemiah. He was scared. His dilemma was great. But he also recognized that in this great, even life-threatening dilemma, could come the greatest opportunity of his life. For he had the opportunity to address the king who could make a difference to resolve the dilemma. And that's why, because he understood it, that he invites us to understand that life's greatest opportunities often grow out of life's greatest dilemmas. But that's not all. Nehemiah has a second piece of advice in verses 2 through 4. It is the advice to recognize that God's opportunities come at God's time. When Artaxerxes addressed the cupbearer, he of course had no choice but to answer him, although he did have a choice in the type of answer that he would give. Artaxerxes asked Nehemiah, "What's the matter? Why do you look so depressed?" Now he could have made up a smile, as painful as it might be and as artificial, I suppose he could have deceived the king. And he could have given a minor social lie. He could have said, "Oh, I've just not been feeling myself lately, but really everything's fine." He chose to do otherwise. He chose instead to tell the truth. Except remember that this was a time with an absolute monarch, and subordinates were not to bring their personal problems nor individual requests to the king, at least not unless they were asked. And so, carefully choosing his words, Nehemiah explained his sad face in verse 3. He starts out very diplomatically, saying, "Let the king live forever." And then formed it as a question. "Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's sepulchres, lies in waste and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" Nehemiah, in his answer, was both clever and candid. Clever in that he never mentioned the name of the city of Jerusalem, because that would have been a red flag before Artaxerxes and everyone else in the court. Jerusalem was nothing but trouble. In fact, Artaxerxes himself had issued an edict some years earlier, back toward the time of Ezra, saying that Jerusalem was not to be rebuilt. So he very cleverly omits the specific name of Jerusalem, but he very candidly presents the issue and addresses it before the emperor. Now, ordinarily, that would have been the end of the matter. The king would have said what he said. Nehemiah, the cupbearer, would have answered what he answered. And then the king would have picked up his chalice, finished his wine, eaten his dinner, and the topic never again would have been addressed in the royal chambers. Except Artaxerxes took a most unusual initiative. He said in verse 4, "For what do you make request, Nehemiah?" This is such an extraordinary thing for a Medo-Persian emperor to ask, that for all of the centuries since, scholars have written in debate trying to figure out why Artaxerxes would say this. Some have wondered if perhaps he had some very special, unusual relationship with Nehemiah, and that would explain the most extraordinary question. There are others who have picked up out of the context in verse 1 and said, no, this was the 20th anniversary of his rule, and therefore he was dispensing special favors to those in the court because it was an anniversary celebration. But the truth of it is that we really don't know why he did such an unusual thing. Whatever the reason, Nehemiah recognized that God's time of opportunity had come. Nehemiah was like a fuel-short pilot going through a storm with his radio out, who sees a break in the clouds, sees a spot of land and an airstrip there. Or perhaps like the captain of a ship that is taking on water and about to sink in a terrible, tumultuous storm, who experiences a lull, and then to his amazement is able to see through the mist land, And not just land, but a harbor, and a suitable harbor. What does a pilot do at a time like that? He does not fly on hoping that there will be another break in the clouds and another airstrip later on. Nor does the captain of the ship think, oh, well, this is one harbor, there's probably going to be another. Now, when the opportunity comes, when it is the right time, whether it's the place that you would choose or the time that you would choose, you take that opportunity when it arrives and take it as a special gift that has come from God. Nehemiah recognized that it was God's doing. It was God's time. It was God who had even turned the expression on his face, who had manipulated the sight of Artaxerxes so he had a glance at just the right instant, that he could read the emotions and the heart feelings that were expressed in the countenance of his cupbearer. It was God who motivated the man to ask the question. It was God who had been through all of these things to bring it to precisely his right thing at precisely his right time. And it's out of that that Nehemiah gives to us his advice, that we recognize that God's opportunities come at God's time. Oh, it's true that some of us can sometimes control the timing of things because of the connections that we have, or the experience that is ours, or the financial resources that are at our disposal. In fact, some people have a long course of life where in their family and in their business and in their personal affairs, because of the powers that they have been able to pull off the timing. I think those are the most frustrated and desperate people of all when they finally hit up against a wall where all of their money and all of their resources and all of their connections won't work because the dilemma is so great. Nehemiah knew that this was not something he had done. This was something that God had done. We can and we should pray for God's help. But his opportunity comes at his time. Not when we choose it. Not when we control it. But his time. And that begs a question. It begs the question, how do we know that it's God's time? How do we know that it is not something that we have controlled? How do we know that it is not an evil turn of circumstance rather than a divine turn of circumstance? I think there is a practical answer to that. I think at least the first half of the practical answer is that we know it's God's time when it was simply not our doing and can be explained in no other way except it being God. For when there is no human explanation to the opportunities coming and the timing of it, then clearly we credit it to being God's time. But that'd be only half the answer. The other half of the answer is that this man, Nehemiah, for 4 months, day and night, had been talking to God about this. And so his heart and his spirit were finely tuned to the heart and the spirit of the Almighty. He and God had spent day after day after day talking about this matter. And so when God's time came, he knew it was God's time because of the preparation and prayer that had gone before. Now let's get on to Nehemiah's last piece of advice. After we've understood that great opportunities often grow out of great dilemmas, and after we've recognized that God's opportunities come at God's time, then grab the opportunity when it comes. Back in 1920s, Dr. Alexander Fleming was working in St. Mary's Hospital in London. He had an assistant, what he would call a laboratory assistant, who carelessly left the windows of the laboratory open. And some debris came in the windows and ruined some of the cultures that he was working on. I'm sure he was irate and deeply disappointed, for much of his work was ruined. He threw many of the cultures away, and for reasons that I don't know, he saved some of them. Saved some of them and discovered later on that there was a mold that was growing. And he recognized that that was his God-given opportunity. And he grabbed that opportunity, and Alexander Fleming became the discoverer of penicillin. That's quite a contrast to a man whose name is much less familiar to those of us here. That is David Rice Atchison. David Atchison was the president pro tem of the United States Senate in 1849. That was when President-elect Zachary Taylor refused to be inaugurated on a Sunday because of religious scruples against being inaugurated on the Lord's Day. Inauguration then was at the beginning of March, and because of deference to the president-elect, the inauguration was postponed from Sunday, March 4th, 1849, to Monday, March 5th, 1849. That meant, because of some strange twists of history and of constitutional law, that David Atchison, the president pro tem of the Senate, became the president of the United States that Sunday in between. On Saturday night, he went to a gala inaugural party. He came home worn out from all of the partying, went to bed and put a sign on his door that said, "Do not disturb under any circumstances." My, he slept well all the way until Monday morning when he woke up just in time for the inauguration. He was president of the United States for one day, and he slept all day. Now, he did not grab the opportunity that was his. But Nehemiah did. And so he said, starting in verse 5, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's sepulchres, that I may rebuild it." And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, "How long will you be gone, and when will you return?" So it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. And I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, let letters be given me to the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple and for the wall of the city and for the house which I shall occupy." There's some interesting grabbing of the opportunity here. Of course, Nehemiah's prayers were answered, 4 months' worth, and in that I know he was delighted. The God-given opportunity, it had arrived. But there's something we need to understand here. Even though for 4 months he had prayed, even though God had providentially brought all of these events and circumstances and persons together, even though it was precisely God's time and God was doing his thing, do not think that in an instant the walls of Jerusalem, miles and miles away, were rebuilt. They didn't suddenly pop up. For the working out, even of the opportunity that God had given, required that there be travel to Jerusalem, required that there be passports of access past hostile forces along the way, required that there be timber for the gates and for the temple and for the construction of the walls and the house in which Nehemiah would live. All of those things, it meant a great deal of work. In fact, I would go so far as to say that if Nehemiah had declined the opportunity that God had given, life would be a whole lot easier for him back at Susa in the role of the cupbearer to the emperor. To take the opportunity, to grab the opportunity, was the more difficult and the more demanding course for him to take. But he grabbed it anyway. Now, Nehemiah's requests here, they're bold. But the king granted him what he asked. Because in Nehemiah's words, "The good hand of my God was upon me." I like Nehemiah. He's one of those guys who I just sort of sense has his act together. He grabbed the opportunity when God gave it. He enthusiastically undertook all of the work that came with it. And yet he was very careful to give the credit to God. What's your opportunity? As a church, we're facing an opportunity for building not a wall in Jerusalem, but a worship center, an opportunity that is rooted in the dilemma of growth that is greater than our resources. And so we as a church have collectively decided that we're going to grab the opportunity and that we're going to go with God. What's your opportunity? Has God given you right now an opportunity, a chance at a change? Something for which you have long prayed? Something for which you have long waited? Is this right now your great opportunity, God's time, to do something great with him, then grab it. Grab the opportunity and go with God. What's your opportunity? You say you have none. You say that you have prayed long, far more than 4 months. You've waited long, maybe most of a lifetime, and it still hasn't come. It still hasn't happened. Well, then, like Nehemiah, wait for the Lord. Wait for the Lord to bring your marriage, the child, the cure, the job, the opportunity. Wait for God's time. Oh, that's hard. No one underestimates the difficulty of it. Wait for God's time. Wait and get ready. And when God's opportunity comes, grab it and go with God.